Spit and Twitches is part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Hey, Tom, it's Bob from the office down the hall. It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been?
Well, after the horribly successful pilot, have been okay for me. I had two comments on with Lori, which was great. I thought, what better time to do this again than when we're having a snow squall? And Dave Mumby, who's from... is it snow out there, Dave, or is it sort of rainy snow?
Hard to tell. It looks more like sleet right now.
Yeah, sort of, so it should be great driving later. So Dave Mumby from Concordia University is visiting us here at Algoma, and rather than have to go through the trouble of talking to somebody over Skype, and it's actually a lot more fun just talking face-to-face anyway, I thought I'd have Dave on the old show, so thanks for coming, Dave.
No problem. Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. What kind of... I mean, you are really... Your training is, and you are, a behavioral neuroscientist, but your interest has always been sort of on the big, I guess almost sort of macro questions for a neuroscientist about behavior, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm certainly more interested in the proper psychological interpretation of behavioral data from animals than I am in understanding the mechanisms that operate in their brain that control those behaviors. Although I find myself doing a lot of research that concerns questions about the brain. It's really the behavior.
Yeah.
And how to really interpret it that I find it the most interesting. Probably because I find it the most challenging. Not that there's not enough challenges to poking around the brain properly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've just always really been more interested in trying to figure out what this behavior means in terms of the cognitive processes or other kind of mechanisms, the psychological processes that underlie the behavior.
And you did your undergrad at, was it Alberta?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Did you get in, were you interested in the same sort of topic then, or?
No, I can't say I was interested in much when I was an undergraduate. I was, no, quite honestly, I was in a general science program as an undergraduate, and my first semester as a student did not go very well. Luckily, I had started in January. And I'd only passed one course that first semester. It was my intro psych course.
Nice.
And I made the guess that since I passed that course, I must have this affinity for psychology.
Well, that seems like a reasonable assumption, yeah.
Well, the thing is, next year I loaded up on a few more psychology courses because I got the social reinforcement from passing one. And then, but some of these courses dealt with drugs and the brain.
Yeah.
And I just got really fascinated.
Right.
By the drugs and by the brain, and you know, my neuropsychology classes, my pharmacology classes.
Right.
I just couldn't get enough of that. So after that, I just was avidly taking every neuro-related course I could.
Sure.
and even then, I can't say I was motivated by the need to know more, like to do basic research.
No, sure.
I didn't even have a particular life plan in mind when I was an undergraduate.
Oh,
so
who did? I mean, I don't know many people. Well, I mean, I went into psychology because I was going to help cure the crazy people.
Yeah.
You know, I really was. That's, I think, a lot of people do. So, I mean, it's not that different because I do completely the opposite of that now. Oh, well, the opposite.
Yes.
But
yeah, you cause people problems.
I was going to say, yes, I actually cause psychological problems. So, I mean, what you're saying is that atypical. I think it's probably also heartening for a lot of undergrads to hear that, you know, you start out, you don't do that well. I mean, that happens to a lot of people. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, I only got into graduate school because I told this fellow, he was actually my professor in my neuropharmacology and my psychopharmacology courses, and he was a really hard-nosed, strict teacher.
Yeah.
He didn't give out easy marks. And I really liked him because he was one of these no BS kinds of guys.
Nice.
And I don't know where I got the nerve, but one day I went up to him and I asked him if I could help in his lab. I didn't even know that it was something you could.
That wasn't a thing you did, yeah.
But I just got the balls one day to go up and ask.
Nice.
And he asked me why I wanted to. And, you know, the real reason is because I thought it would be cool and interesting, but I actually gave him a much better answer. Luckily, I said, well, because I'm interested in a career in research in neuroscience, in behavioral neuroscience. And apparently I said exactly the right things that a professor wants to hear from a young student.
Yeah, it's true.
That I was motivated to you know, get in more knowledge and get involved in research in this area. And so he took me on as a master's student. And it was really only as a graduate student that I started to really, really learn the material that I was about.
No, I think that's true with a lot of us. I remember talking with the colleague about statistics, saying you never understand your first statistics course till you take your second. You never understand your second till you go to your graduate school. And you never really understand the introduction stats, even though you thought you did, until you actually have to teach it. I think that's not atypical. That I remember also, whenever I send my students off to grad school, I tell them, you'll learn more in a week than you used to learn in a term. Mm-hmm. because you're doing stuff you like and you're interested in, and also a lot more is expected of you, etc. And then you went off to UBC after
that. Well, not right away. I did my master's at U of Alberta too. And then I went to UBC for my PhD.
Right.
And that really changed a lot for me, because I got into a different research area there. I got into a topic that's been pretty big in behavioral neuroscience for actually quite a long time, and that's the brain and learning and memory processes, how the brain enables us to learn and remember things and use that information. Before that, I was studying a phenomenon called schedule-induced polydipsia.
Okay.
Didn't really have too much. In fact, it was devoid of cognitive processes entirely.
Yeah.
but I have to also say that doing research on some basic behavioral phenomenon without the what often is clutter is cognitive explanations for why behavior emerges.
Mm.
It was helpful for me in the long run to be looking at a really basic, I don't want to say reflexive behavior, but it was something, this form of adjunctive behavior, this excessive drinking is something the animal does as a result of Pavlovian conditioning. Doesn't seem to be a very rational type of behavior that the animal's engaged in, but it seems to be a product of either non-associative mechanisms or simple associative mechanisms. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to have any cognition at all. And why I think that's important is because there's a tendency now, I feel, that people look at animals' behavior and they're apt to want to put some cognitive explanation on why the animal is behaving in this way in this particular situation.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think it's important to understand that cognitive and non-cognitive mechanisms can be interacting on an ongoing basis, and controlling an animal's behavior doesn't always come down to some cognitive explanation.
No, I mean, I remember, I always joke about this. I remember, in fact, with Jerry Cullen years ago, we were talking about, this is when I was an undergrad, I said to him, there's sort of two schools of thought. There's the idea that animals don't do anything at all, don't think at all, and that's your Skinner. I said, then on the other hand, you've got Tolman, who believed that, rats should be able to vote. and it's somewhere in the middle. I mean, I was kidding, of course. Please don't take away my PhD. so then you finished doing that. You went off to UBC, and you worked with John Pinnell, right?
That's right. I worked with John Pinnell, and it was a great 4 years that I spent at UBC. I learned a lot, so much, and so much more in that 4 years. And it wasn't just because I had a good supervisor.
Sure.
I think, in fact, John's greatest asset as a supervisor was that he really fostered independence in his students. He didn't want his students to become, replicas of him.
Yeah.
Who thought and had the same kinds of preoccupations as he did. And so he really let me pursue lines of questions that I wanted to.
Yeah.
He reassured me that some of the ideas were worth pursuing when I always didn't have the sophistication to be able to tell whether this was important or not. Should I go in this direction? Should I go in that direction?
Yes.
He was able to tell me, people are going to care about this. They're not going to care as much about that.
That's right.
This is a more useful direction. So he's very good in that way. He's incredibly supportive. But I also benefited a lot from being a graduate student at UBC in the biopsychology area at a time when there happened to be a whole lot of other really strong senior graduate students
there
too. And I came in with this master's from U of A, and at the time there's about five or six really impressive PhD students already at UBC. And I really was impressed by these guys.
Right.
You know, they were all really, really smart, really productive, too, in the labs, and they were publishing their work, and they were all party animals and just really good guys, too. So it was great.
Yeah, I mean, that's, we ended up meeting through another fellow graduate of yours, Rob Wilson, who was a conference buddy of mine.
Yeah.
And that's how we ended up meeting. And I mean, I don't want to say that it was some sort of magical time, because I think every time is pretty good, but there was a lot of real excitement, I think, then in this sort of area, and you were sort of always of the group of all of us, you were the physiology guy, and we were much more the behavioral people. Do you think that, I mean, you know, knowing people like Rob or whoever, and also being at UBC at the time, do you think that influenced your ideas about how, maybe this is going too far, but saying that, like, studying the brain is not always an end in and of itself, it's just sort of a means to understand cognition and behavior?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I'd say that, you know, having friends like Rob and you and the other people that I would say are, you know, you identify with animal cognition, that's their areas of interest.
Yeah.
I got a lot from that. In particular, Don Wilkie, who was Rob Wilson's supervisor at UBC. I spoke to him a lot, constantly.
Right.
And he was always checking me, too. You know, checking my interpretations. He's a very kind guy, so we do it in a nice, gentle way, too.
But, yes.
You know, when I had some explanation or account of something that was vacuous or, you know, pretty empty,
yes,
he was really quick to point out. And he was very good at that, too. So I think he really sharpened my appreciation for interpreting behavioral phenomena, the complications involved in doing it, and those conversations that we had.
No, exactly. I mean, we used to talk about these things all the time over you know, copious amounts of liquor, because we were usually at conferences and stuff. Many of which we probably should have recorded back then, because they're lost in the memory hole of history. So then you ended up getting your job. I know you had a postdoc as well, and then you end up getting your job at Concordia pretty quickly. What kind of questions did you start getting into, sort of cognition-wise, and then looking at the brain angle? What kind of questions have you been interested in?
Okay, well, a lot of this was kind of by fluke, too, or just circumstances. So my entry into the field of cognition, and in particular studying it in animals, really started when I went to UBC for my PhD.
Right.
In fact, my first research project that I was involved in there had to do with sex and alcohol. And I don't mean that as a joke. I mean, I was doing that every night there, too, or trying anyway. The alcohol, I was trying this, you know. But but my chance to really do both was in the lab. And I started on a project that was aimed to sort of replicate a really fascinating phenomenon that a guy named Jim Faust, who's now my colleague at Concordia, he was a PhD student, one of these impressive PhD students I was talking about. He was working in the same lab, and he had just finished publishing a study where he reported that low doses of alcohol disinhibit sexual behavior in male rats.
Sure.
So I got involved in a series of projects trying to extend, to determine how generalizable that phenomenon was. But in the meantime, my supervisor, Pinella, was writing a textbook, his brain and behavior textbook. It was on psychobiology.
Yeah.
Biopsychology. He was writing the first edition of that. He was on the chapter on learning and memory, and he was writing about animal models of human amnesia. And the benchmark task in these monkey models of a human amnesia back in the late 1980s was delayed non-matching a sample.
Sure.
Administered in a Wisconsin general testing apparatus to monkeys.
Yeah.
And John, while he's writing this chapter, he was thinking about what a shame it was that the only good animal model of human amnesia was a primate model.
Right.
He realized that a rodent model would be so much more accessible.
Oh, sure.
Cheaper, and we could learn more if we had a good animal model. So yeah. He thought the way to do this would be to devise a delayed non-matching sample task for rats
yeah.
that worked like the monkey test.
Yeah.
And he got me to... He convinced me to muck around with some things in the lab to try to get something to work. And after several months of mucking around with different apparatuses and procedures, came up with a procedure that actually successfully, you know, we were able to teach rats to perform this monkey-like recognition task. And they were actually able to perform very well with their attention delays up to several minutes. So it really started for me with this development of a procedure.
I remember reading some of this stuff because I was in grad school and Sarah Sherwood brought me this paper. I said, "Well, you've met him. He's that guy that I was drinking with at the conference." And because that was the one with the so-called Mumby box, right?
Right.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, it was really neat because, like you said, you got these several minute delays,
mm-hmm.
which is something that. It's very difficult to get in rodents, except on radio mitts, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get minutes, hours, retention intervals. You're talking seconds typically, right? Same thing with, like, say, pigeons, right? You know, like, more than 5 seconds, a pigeon looks stupid.
Yeah.
So
this is, it started that way, with it, without me even really being, starting off with some genuine interesting questions about memory. But once ended up with this working behavioral protocol, it was obvious that there were some really obvious and important lesion experiments that needed to be done. At around the same time that we developed this task, the dominant story in the primate literature was that human amnesia was caused by combined damage to the two circuits. One that had the hippocampus as its central component, and the other had the amygdala as its central component. These also included diencephalic and frontal structures too, but the hippocampus and the amygdala were these two medial temporal lobe structures that had to be damaged together in order to produce a full-blown amnesic syndrome.
Right. This was the Michigan stuff, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
So because you know there's already data out there from monkeys saying that hey, if you damage just the hippocampus, it doesn't mess them up on this task very much. If you damage just the amygdala, it doesn't. Doesn't mess them up too much, but if you damage them both together, they're really messed up.
Right.
So, well, let's see if we could confirm that in rats.
Right.
And, I did that straightforward lesion experiments and found, just like Michigan did in his monkeys, hippocampal lesions had negligible effects on the ability to recognize these objects.
Yeah.
So did amygdala lesions, but so did combined amygdala and hippocampal lesions. So at first, you know, the story in the rats wasn't entirely consistent with the story in the primates. But at about the same time I was getting these, which at first seemed like disappointing results, where the combined lesion group performed normally, the story in the monkey literature was starting to change, and people were discovering that it wasn't the hippocampus and amygdala after all, it was this little bit of cortex that was inadvertently and inevitably damaged whenever people went in and
made these
large aspiration lesions. And it was really these cortical areas surrounding the hippocampus and the amygdala that played the dominant role in this memory ability.
Right.
So I did the next obvious lesion experiment.
Yes.
Let's do the lesions of that little area of cortex called the perirhinal cortex.
Yeah.
And I didn't make nice little clean lesions of that area, but I made complete lesions, which also included some other cortical areas.
Right.
But lo and behold, I did produce deficits in these rats, delay dependent, where they performed normally with a very brief delay of a few seconds, but they couldn't perform with the delay over.
Yeah. And that sounds. I mean, from the little bit I do know about human amnesia, that sounds perfect, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Now so I'm doing these. I'm becoming a very good surgeon.
Right.
In the process of all this too, and I'm testing rats a lot on this task. Now I guess I'm still not at this point. When I was doing my PhD work, I wasn't doing much more than trying to reproduce in rats some of the things that had already been done in monkeys, just to demonstrate the utility of the rodent model.
Sure.
But I guess it was from going to conferences, meeting a lot of established researchers, as well as some younger ones like me, and getting more involved in presenting at conferences, talking with people, and debating, really debating what was going on. That was when I started to experience the what I thought was a really superficial, a tendency to apply really superficial interpretation of behavioral data. In other words, people really did tend to interpret every time an animal doesn't perform like a control animal on some task that you administer for the purpose of assessing memory, then we should conclude that that animal has an impaired memory.
Right.
And I was just, I remember I was always thinking, these people can't really think it's that simple, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I guess so. I was never really became passionate about digging deep into the brain mechanisms underlying the impairments that I'd see on the task. I became more concerned with trying to understand when a deficit in performance means an impairment of memory,
right?
And when instead a deficit in performance really probably means something else. And the kinds of ways you can, what I've really always liked is the way you can design an experiment.
Yeah.
You don't have to use new techniques or new methods, but just the design of an experiment.
Yes.
Can discount certain interpretations of the data.
Sure.
And I've always just found myself more attracted by these challenges of trying to figure out how to do something in a way that'll be a little bit more revealing than the way we've been doing it in the past.
Right.
So things like building or devising ways of assessing memory that is probably more accurate or more reliable than those methods that we already have. So that started with the development of that old delayed non-maximum sample task for rats.
Yeah.
Not that I use that task anymore. I haven't for many years because it's simply just too cumbersome and labor-intensive.
I was going to say, it's got to be labor-intensive as hell.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to do stuff like that, and I still have, with you know, birds, with chickadees. I run one trial a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally one trial a day. Just like people do with the radio maze. Mm-hmm. They're running one trial a day. Or maybe two. You might run two, right? You might, it's like eight pieces of food, or four if it's four and four, whatever. But you're done. So, I mean, I remember always trying to explain to my colleagues to this day. Well, not so much here, because almost all of us except one person in our apartment actually have worked with animals. But when I was in grad school, especially, you know, people would say, oh, I'm collecting data this week. It's like, I've been collecting data this year, you know, for seven freaking days a week. And I have to feed my subjects, you know. If I don't show up to work in the lab, my subjects die. What happens when you don't? You know, so it's a whole different world. And that is because we're smarter and better looking. What kind of stuff are you doing now? What kind of tasks are you using now that if you're not using that cool task?
Yeah. Well, this is a really interesting and good time for you to ask this question. Because now, I'll say the last, I guess, 10 years or 11 years, my students have made, they've worked really hard and done a lot of, they've published a lot of studies involving we call a novel object preference task.
Mm-hmm.
It goes by different monikers out there. People call it an object recognition task or spontaneous object recognition. Although I think names are very important, and I chose to call this novel object preference because that actually describes what the test is.
Yeah.
Anyway, this novel object preference task is a really convenient way of getting a quick assessment of object recognition ability in rats. It took care of all those cumbersome, painstaking, time, you know, consuming aspects of the delayed non-match in the sample task. Because in this task, in the novel object preference test, you simply give the animal a period of time to investigate two identical objects in an open field arena. Then you remove them from the arena for some retention delay. Then you put them back in.
Mm-hmm.
And now, again, they've got two objects, but one's identical to the one that they've investigated.
Yep.
And one's novel.
Yep.
And in most situations, not all, but in depending on details of the situation, normal rats will tend to spend more time investigating the novel object than the one they've seen before.
Sure.
And when an animal shows that reliable preference for a novel object over one they've seen before, it is safe to infer that the animal recognizes the sample object.
That seems reasonable.
Well, the definition of object recognition is detecting the familiarity of an object that's been previously encountered. So the problem with the novel object preference task, because although we've used it so much in the last 11 years, I've never really thought it was a very good way of testing memory. And many observations that my students and I have made over the years have just reinforced that idea and convinced me that it's not only not a very good way to assess object recognition memory, but it's being misused, abused by behavioral neuroscientists so much that I just think it's time that there is greater awareness of the interpretational limitations of this task. And I've also decided, and that's why I say this is good timing for this question, I've just submitted a grant application, and the proposal is to really work on developing a better method of assessing recognition in rats.
Right.
My students and I have actually been, for the past few years, trying to establish a new behavioral protocol for assessing object recognition in rats, one that would have all the interpretational advantages of the old delayed unmatching the sample task, but not all those practical disadvantages.
Yeah.
So we're looking for something that can provide a pretty precise assessment of different degrees of recognition ability, and to do so in a fairly short time.
Okay.
Now, the problem with the novel object preference task is you can get a lot of data in a fairly short time, but it's really difficult to know what it means when the animals don't show a preference for the novel object. People tend to think that a lack of a preference in the novel logic preference task must mean a failure of memory.
Yeah,
although I said, when they do show a preference, it's safe to assume that they
recognize. But when they don't, it doesn't have to show that they don't. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Now, that's true of many tasks, right?
You
always have
to. Know why no results happen, as I want to tell my students. You know.
But the novel logic preference task seems to be more racked with alternative interpretations of a lack of interpretation than the typical task. So, and here's here's a few of our observations that we've made that have made me even more concerned about how to really interpret the lack of a preference on that task. People assume that the degree of preference, so the magnitude of the preference somehow reflects the strength of the memory. So in other words, an animal with a stronger memory of the sample object should have a higher relative preference for the novel object than one with a weaker memory for the sample object. That all makes sense. And that's in line with the way people do statistical analysis. They tend to compare group means to each other rather than what we do, which I think is at least the right place to start, is you compare a group's mean to what would be expected by
chance.
To just ask that basic question, does this group show evidence of recognition or not? But that isn't the most popular way that other people analyze the data. They simply compare the controls and the treatment groups without respect to whether either of those groups are showing evidence of recognition. And if there's a significant difference between the group scores, the inference is, hey, there's a memory impairment. Anyway, so there's those kind of interpretational problems. Now, if the strength of the memory is related to the magnitude of the preference, then one should predict that the more time spent encoding the object, the higher the ratio should be.
Yes.
Because everyone will agree that within some range anyway, the strength or accuracy of a memory is going to be related to the amount of encoding.
Yeah.
Right? And everybody also agrees that when the animal is investigating the object during the sample phase, that's when they're encoding information about it.
Yeah.
So we've gone through several data sets over from various experiments we've done over the years, trying to see simply if there's a correlation between the amount of time the animals spend investigating an object during the learning phase and the degree of the subsequent ratio that they show on the preference test. And there's no significant correlation.
Oh,
we've looked at this in several data sets and we don't find it. I've asked Now, data correlational data tend not to be reported in the behavioral neuroscience literature using this task, but I've talked to a lot of other people who've used it, you know, and they say, oh yeah, we don't see correlation either. And I think,
really?
Because the correlation isn't there, when people expect it to be, they don't make a big deal out of the fact that it isn't there. You know, people don't want to present their troublesome data.
Yeah.
So they overlook and they don't think it's much of a concern that this expected correlation isn't to be found. Now, those are just correlational data, and we determined a couple of years ago it was important to get experimental data.
Sure. Yeah.
So we actually did an experiment where we controlled the amount of time the animals were allowed to investigate that sample object. And again, there wasn't the predicted relationship between encoding time or investigation time and the magnitude of the resulting preference. So if they're allowed to investigate the objects for 15 seconds or 5 seconds, 15 seconds, or 30 seconds, they didn't show a preference subsequently 3 hours later. But if they got 60 seconds, 120 seconds, or more to investigate the objects, they showed a preference.
Right.
The thing is, the magnitude of the preference wasn't dependent on how much time. As long as they got more than 30 seconds, they showed a preference. But increasing the amount of encoding time beyond that did not lead to...
Well, could it be like a ceiling effect, though? Like, you just can't go anymore since the task is that easy?
It's possible, but then that would have to say that, okay, it's, you know, somewhere between 30 and 60 seconds,
well, yeah, that's probably
you go from knowing not enough to show any evidence of memory to being able to show
to fill it up
maximum evidence of memory, highest possible ratio.
Yeah.
It really comes down to this. There's no sensitivity in terms of this.
It's a binary thing almost.
It's exactly. Yeah. So I think it really is a good, effective task to use as a screen if you really want to get a quick screen. If say you're a pharmacologist and you want to look at a bunch of compounds, and this would be a good first, quick, easy thing to put them through.
Yeah.
But then if you get a lack of a preference, potential evidence of a memory impairment, I think you really got to go out there with an actual memory test and determine whether there is a memory impairment or not.
Right.
So, I hope we can continue to have some success in developing a task that will end up looking more like old-fashioned delayed non-matching sample tasks.
Right.
But won't look like them in the sense that rats will be able to master them pretty quickly.
Yeah. Right. And would you want to do this with sort of objects again?
Or yeah.
Just some
it's with objects, and this the question is particularly about objects and this one type of memory, object recognition memory. Now, I am interested in memory in a much more general sense. We have done a lot with some object recognition work, though. So that is what specifically I'm talking about here, is developing a better way of assessing object recognition memory. Now, the apparatus and procedures that we are in the process of tuning will allow us to look at spatial memory and context.
So definitely you can look at you can look at all kinds of different sort of modalities as well, not
absolutely.
Just you may even be able then to do some fun sort of species different stuff too, because I mean, you think about, you start seeing differences, those kind of things show up, especially in sort of spatial stuff. At least that's what people tend to find. That's probably the easiest thing to do, because we can think of ecological variables that over evolutionary time have affected spatial memory rather than other things. So, you know, you can compare, I don't know, male and female pine voles versus meadow voles or something like that, right? Because you might be able to get something very subtle there and get a lot of data very quickly, which is nice. Because, I mean, like I said before, one of the... Not that I dislike collecting, well, of course I dislike, I hate, running experiments is drudgery. The first day and the last day are great. The middle is just, you know, moments of boredom, or hours and hours of boredom punctuated by moments of sheer terror. Oh my God, I did it wrong! You know, it really is. I mean, I know there are people that love putting rats on mazes. I think these people are insane. You know, I ran birds all those times. I liked the idea of what I was doing. But actually, just writing down, it went to feeder number 2, it went to feeder number 3, sucks. you know, or putting pigeons in boxes, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anything you can get data quickly, I'm all for. Also, because a lot of times, too, you know, you, I don't know you, but you come up with ideas, and you think, oh, yeah, but I gotta have to, this is a little side idea I have, and I'm going to have to, you know, put 6 months into this. So that's awesome if you can come up with something that's quick and, you know. I want something instant. It's just some sort of machine. I can just push a button and it'll tell me the answer.
Well, you know, that's the kind of desire, though, that's really made people buy into the novel object preference task and adopt it so widely. And, you know, you can see all the reasons.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a problem. It's just a problem when the when there's laxness in the terms of interpreting what the behavior really
is. Yeah, and I mean, I think that one of the things, and this is, I've always said this in my learning class, when one of the last 2 weeks of the learning class, the first, you know, few weeks, it's Skinner, it's Pavlov, it eventually is, you know, Roscorla and Timberlake and all this other much more cooler and interesting stuff. And then I get into, like, just hardcore animal cognition, so I teach them, but that's just the last 2 weeks, because, I mean, they got to learn all of learning in 12 weeks, so. And I end with, you know, one of the last topics is, you know, why does anybody study this stuff anymore? Isn't it done? And, I mean, you point out to them during the term, I mean, you can say things like, nope, they have ears here on you know, I don't know, stuff on shuttle boxes. We've pretty much figured this one out now. You know, it stops in the 60s at some point. So, and I'd say to them, like, what's the use of doing this anymore? Isn't everything going to be eventually done by behavioral neuroscientists? And, you know, and of course I'm setting them up for a straw man, but they're all writing it down. Except for the one, there's usually one or two people that are still sort of thinking, I think Dave's kind of stringing us along here. Because I was saying, you know, somebody's got to design the clever behavioral experiments and understand behavior and understand cognition. And I'm not saying that people that do neuroscience stuff are dumb, because I wouldn't be friends with you. But I don't suffer fools gladly. But on the other hand, I think that a lot of times people get so into the neural mechanisms, which are great things, but they get so into them, they completely forget they're dealing with a live animal that has an evolutionary history, it has cognitive abilities that aren't the same as every other animal, too. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And I think, like, one of the reasons that I think your stuff's kind of cool is that you seem to keep that in mind.
Well,
You're not just doing petri dish neuroscience, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I keep it in mind, but, you know, it wasn't always in my mind because, again, I started off developing a rat version of a primate memory task, which
was
about
looking at
disrespectful.
People.
Yeah, which was looking at people.
Yes.
Right. And now I have a much better appreciation of why it's not wise to treat rats like they're humans in little white fur coats.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can get them to do a task that's based on a human memory task. But I think it's folly to infer to assume that they're solving the task the same way.
Oh, exactly.
Human is.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's this is the sort of classic thing that Sarah used to always talk about when she calls it the anthropocentric approach to animal cognition research.
Yeah.
You know, it's the implicit question that's being asked in all these things is, can rats do what people do? You know, and that really is the question. And I mean, I've said. Not in print, because I've tried to put it in a much nicer way, but that's like asking, why can't, if you jump out my office window, why can't you fly? Like, that's a bizarre question. But I mean, don't you think that there are some processes that are going to be across the board the same in almost anything that exists, besides habituation, you know, which is very exciting and interesting and boring as hell. Oh, I know Kandel's stuff.
Oh, I think habituation is the basis of this novel object preference, too.
You do? I think
they're habituating their tendency to explore
a really good.
Object.
I think that's actually a pretty good explanation, because
it's probably a lot less cognitive than people think.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that for the most part, that does, because, I mean, habituation happens very quickly. Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, but besides, say, habituation, which, as cool as it is, is still kind of a boring thing.
Okay.
Even though we understand everything about it now, which is great.
Hey, man, don't dishabituation.
Oh, thank you. We'll be here all week. Please try the veal and tip your waitress. aren't there some processes, though, like, say, I don't know, associative learning, that are going to be the same in almost every species? I mean, that's another thing that shows up in pretty much everything.
Yeah, I think that there's some merit to sort of general processes, ways of thinking
about
some of these mechanisms, but I think that, again, that the problem is taking general processes, ways of thinking too far, and not and thinking that it accounts for the details. Like, one of the things that, you know, we talked earlier today about teaching and learning. And well, we mentioned just a few moments ago how he spent almost the whole semester talking about Pavlovian and then instrumental learning, and you only get to throw in a bit of cognitive stuff at the end because there's not enough time to do everything in one semester. Well, shoot, I can't remember what my point was going to be.
Well, let's not worry about it then.
Yeah. I was.
No, you're talking about general
really
processes.
Profound. It was,
you're talking about general processes.
Yeah, general processes. Yeah. One of the things that, you know, comes up in that intro to learning course is, you know, after we talk about these general laws of learning, these ways it works in all mammals. You know, we generalize. These are supposed to be general processes.
That's right.
General laws of learning.
That's
and every once in a while in that course, though, in most textbooks, there'll be this exception, right?
Yeah.
Oh, the raccoons couldn't learn to pick up
Breeland,
you know,
and Breeland. Yes.
And you know what? I think it's those exceptions that are ultimately, you know, they inform us not just about the limits of the general processes, but there's an explanation behind these exceptions too.
And well, that's
the exceptions are actually things that are happening for good reason.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I got into doing this stuff. And I mean, one of the reasons that I wanted to work with Sarah Shuttleworth was because she was Sarah Shuttleworth. I mean, I'm not gonna lie here. I looked and I went, wow, that's really cool work, and she's famous and stuff. But the other part of it was that, oh, okay, and Bill Roberts and Nancy Innes said, you know, you should go work with Sarah Shuttleworth. She's really good. But the other one was, I was reading some of this stuff on food storing, and I thought, well, this is cool. This isn't rats on an eight-arm maze. This is something cool and interesting that this animal does that most of them don't. Most birds are smart enough to fly south for the winter. These ones hang around in the winter and store food, right? And one of the things that really struck me about it was that we were looking at something, and she was looking at something in her students that was special and different. And I do think that that's where, I mean, I'm biased, but I think that's where the excitement comes from. And as somebody who was a Shuttleworth student, but also somebody who's done other stuff, I'm not denying that the general process stuff's there. You'd be ridiculous. You know, there's reference memory and working memory. I'm pretty happy with that. That's cool, you know. But there are things that have been tweaked. Birdsong. I talked to Lori last time. I mean, she has communication. There's also Birdsong. Jen Foote here in our biology department does Birdsong. There's all these other sort of specialized systems, depending on the species. They might be doing something different and special, and I think that that's, to me, that's where the excitement is. Mm-hmm. But it's also, I mean, having been a Bill Roberts postdoc, it's also, there's something to be said for varying parameters and really doing hardcore. How does this work? How does matching to sample work here, and here? Mm-hmm. But I think we can have a happy medium between those two, but realize that the question isn't, can you fly if you jump out my window? The question is, why can birds fly when they jump out the window, and why are we able to invent the airplane? I mean, I think that that's the more interesting question.
Well, those were three questions, actually, though.
Yeah, well, fair enough. My show. I'm going to do something that I did with Lori, and I'm going to ask you four questions that just come to mind.
All right.
If you were to tell, I know you're very interested in helping people get into graduate school, you've written a book about this and all this stuff. If you were to give one piece of advice to an undergraduate about, just one, and it can't be by your book, one piece of advice to get about getting into graduate school, what's the best piece of advice?
Well, I have to do it in one piece, eh? Okay.
Yeah. What do you think's the key?
The key is not believing, or the key is to understand that getting in isn't based on who deserves it the most.
Nice. Okay. Okay, so I've always wondered how I got a U of T. That's good. If we were to do a running race between John Pinnell and Ron Wiseman.
Ron Wiseman.
it's but both in their prime.
He's always in your athletic.
I have to put him in. I don't got a thing for putting Ron in these competitions. Who wins? But remember, they're both in their prime. So they're both, let's say, they're both 25 years old. If you didn't know either of them, then neither did I. But who do you think would win in a running race, 100 meters?
Oh, you know what? I think it's irrelevant because afterwards, doesn't matter which one you talk to, they'd say that they won. And they'll be talking about it forever.
Wow, that was an excellent answer. If you couldn't study, if you didn't go in the direction you went in, and when you, like, you know, we all have these times we look back and go, you know, I could have done this. What do you look back and think, I could have done research on this, or I could have had this other, even other career? Do you ever, what do you think it would, what do you think of when you take those looks back?
Boy, I think I could have, well, I certainly could have been involved in petty crime in all sorts of different ways. In terms of getting turned on into research, I feel like a real scientist now, and I love the research process. I'm not as interested in some of the questions that I've been studying for many years now that, as I used to be. So I think I would like to get in a completely different area of research. It would be something like wildlife management.
Cool.
Okay. I like being outside. Like,
well, that's kind of cool. I don't think I could do that, but then somehow I imagine it involves seeing better. That's always my excuse. So. Well, thanks a lot, Dave. Thanks. I really appreciate you sitting down with me. And it's Beaujolais Nouveau Thursday, and we're going to drink a lot of wine tonight.
Excellent.
All right.
By the way, there's only three questions.
I couldn't think of a fourth.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. It was fun.
Thanks. That was awesome. 46 minutes. That's almost the first credit.
It's good to see you, buddy. How have you been? Things have been okay for me, except that I'm a zombie now. I really wish you'd let us in. I think I speak for all of us when I say I understand why you folks might hesitate to submit to our demand. But here's an FYI, you're all gonna die. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside and eat your brains. I don't wanna nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating you slowly.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. Another meeting time. wrap it up. No, we'll get to common ground somehow. Meanwhile, I'll report back to my colleagues who were chewing on the doors. I guess we'll table this for now. I'm glad to see you take constructive criticism well. Thank you for your time. I know we're all busy as hell. And we'll put this thing to bed when I bash your head open.
All we wanna do is eat your brains.
We're not unreasonable. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. Maybe we should compromise. Open up the door.